content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Joe Austin, and I'm your host and producer for today's episode of Legal Matters, an original program produced in the North Carolina Reading Service studio. And for the next half hour, we're going to pick up on a very important topic that we introduced and spoke at some length about last month. And our guest, again, is Xavier Lightfoot, a lawyer here in Raleigh with the law firm of Ward & Smith. And our topic is the very important issue of illegal harassment, what it is and what it isn't, and how it is dealt with in the workplace. And just by way of background here, we've covered in the last episode sexual harassment as a violation of Title VII, sexual harassment as a violation of North Carolina law, and then how the principles then translate into other areas of illegal harassment. Xavier, thanks for coming back.
Joe, thank you for having me. It's good to be here with you and your listeners.
Well, we're thrilled to have you back, and you gave us a wonderful program last month, and but there's no way in just a half an hour we can cover everything that we need to cover on illegal harassment. And I'm going to refer our listeners back to our last month's program, because we went through your very impressive credentials at that time. But again, Xavier is a lawyer here in Raleigh with the law firm of Ward & Smith. And so one thing I didn't mention, I need to mention this, Best Lawyers has identified Xavier, and he's in the category of ones to watch. So a rising star in the legal community here in Raleigh and in North Carolina. So, Xavier, again, we're glad to have you. Let's pick up on something that's been in the news, and that is LGBTQ harassment and whether that is covered and protected under Title VII. Go ahead and fill us in on that, Xavier.
Happy to, and thank you for the kind words, Joe. You know, just jumping right back in to follow up on our previous program, LGBTQ plus harassment has been a really prevalent topic over the last few years, and is still a prevalent topic today. The reason for that is that up until the summer of 2020, there was no federal protection for individuals who identified as LGBTQ when it concerns harassment or discrimination in the workplace. There were, you know, it was kind of split across the country. You had half of the states who had some sort of laws on their books at the state level that, you know, provided protections for those individuals who identified as LGBTQ plus in the workplace if they suffered some sort of harassment based off of their sexual orientation or gender identity or gender. And then you had another half of the states who had no such laws. And so up until June of 2020, when our Supreme Court issued a decision in this area that provided federal protection for those individuals, that there was no federal protection. And so in June of 2020, the United States Supreme Court took on a case that is titled Bostick versus Clayton County, Georgia, and issued a decision which basically provides it extends the protections that flow under Title VII to individuals based off of their sexual orientation, their gender identity, and gender in general. So individuals who identify as homosexual or transgender, they have they are entitled to federal protection for those classifications and those identifications, such that they can bring forward a claim for unlawful harassment if they incur some type of unwelcome conduct on those bases. And that was a very important decision handed down by our Supreme Court. It is a, it's a landmark decision, and it is, it, it kind of upended the employment world, because we have not had a decision like this for quite some time affecting a federal statute as it pertains to one of the anti-harassment, anti-discrimination laws. And the reason why, you know, I mean, from a, we won't get into the political standpoint of this. This decision, you know, it may stand the test of time. It may not. You know, when the decision was handed down, the Supreme Court was a little bit different in that we had, both Justice, Ginsburg and Justice Breyer, who were in the majority on those decisions. Justice Breyer recently retired, and Justice Taji Brown Jackson has, been, nominated and appointed, to fill, or to succeed, Justice, Breyer. And then Justice Ginsburg, who, passed away. We have, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who has, been nominated and appointed to the court to, succeed her. So the court is a little bit different, but I think, you know, this decision may stand the test of time to some degree, because, two of the, justices who were in the majority of that opinion, who voted in favor of this decision, Justice, Chief Justice Roberts, John Roberts, and, Justice Neil Gorsuch, they are both still on the court, and likely will be on the court, for the foreseeable future. And so, this was a landmark decision, like I mentioned, but a very important decision. And what it means is this. It means that if you are someone who is, who identifies as homosexual, if you identify as transgender, you have federal protection under the law, for any sort of discrimination and harassment under Title VII. And, just to give you, you know, some more context about the facts and how this could play out, and what are the type of situations that could, you know, make someone want to say, oh, you know, I may have a federal, claim for unlawful harassment or discrimination. Let me tell you about the individuals who made up this Bostic versus Clayton County case. This was a case that was consolidated and made up of three lower court opinions. The first, which the case is named after, Gerald Bostic, that was a child, welfare, services coordinator down in Clayton County, Georgia, who had worked for the county for a number of years, and this individual identified as homosexual. This individual had positive performance evaluations for a number of years, but when it was made aware that he participated in a gay softball league, there were disparaging remarks made about Mr. Bostic by some folks with folks who were higher up in the county, and some of the remarks were even made in a meeting where Mr. Bostic's supervisor was present. Shortly thereafter, these events took place. There was an audit that was basically ordered on Mr. Bostic's department, and shortly thereafter he was terminated. And so he claimed that he was terminated not because of any sort of job performance, poor job performance, but because of his sex, and that he identified as an individual who was homosexual. Another case that made up this larger Supreme Court opinion came out of New York, and it involved an individual who was a skydiving instructor. This individual, when you go skydiving, you are paired with obviously an instructor and the person who's going to be completing the jump, and so you're in tandem. And so to make female jumpers more comfortable in being in this tandem setup, the skydiving instructor would often relay that he identified as homosexual and that the females had nothing to worry about. And there were some complaints made about these type of interactions by some of the skydive jumpers, and Mr. the individual's name was Donald Zarda. Mr. Zarda, who was a skydiving instructor, his supervisor and his employer, they ultimately decided to terminate his employment. And Mr. Zarda claimed that that decision was made because of his status, or on the basis of his sex, which was as a homosexual individual. The last case that made up this larger Supreme Court opinion was involving an individual who initially identified and logically presented as a man, but communicated to her employer, which was a funeral home. She was this individual was a funeral home director. This individual communicated to their employer that they wanted to present in the workplace as who they truly are, and that was as a woman. And so when the individual presented to the workplace as a woman, the employer terminated that individual. The employer basically stated that, you know, it goes against the employer's religion, beliefs, as a Christian, to be able to employ someone who has, transitioned and is transgender and now presents as a woman. And so all three of those cases went up to the Supreme Court, and they formed the larger opinion, that the court handed down. And the court, as I stated, basically said that the protections provided to Title VII, provided under Title VII, which prohibit any sort of discrimination or harassment on the basis of an individual's sex, that also applies to sexual orientation, gender identity, and status as trans, as a transgender individual, because those decisions are made on the basis of sex. And so that is how the federal protections were extended to such individuals within the LGBTQ plus community. And again, this is a big decision, landmark Supreme Court case, and it has changed the way in which employers train their supervisors and their employees, and ultimately how harassment and discrimination has been talked about under the employment lens. A lot of the focus now has been making sure that employees and supervisors understand that it is a federal violation to discriminate or harass someone on the basis of their gender identity or on the basis of their sexual orientation. So this was a really big decision in the employment world.
And would you say it's incumbent on employers not to just sit and wait for these things to happen, but to be proactive in how they deal with the potential for these kinds of cases?
Absolutely. And that's we're seeing a lot of that take place now, especially in light of the Me Too movement and all the media attention that is being brought on this area of our society. I mean, if an employer is not taking preventative steps or proactive steps to train their employees in this particular area, but supervisors and lower level employees, then they are certainly doing themselves a disservice, and it's not a matter of if, but it's just a matter of when they will have a situation where someone is bringing a charge for unlawful harassment, likely on the basis of sex, and bringing a charge before the EEOC, that they will certainly be involved in that sort of situation if they aren't being proactive. And there are numerous practical steps, Joe, that any employer can take and should take to minimize the risk for harassment claims. You can implement effective anti-harassment policies, and make sure that those policies include provisions related to no tolerance for any sort of harassment, instructions for reporting the harassment, more than one person to whom the harassment can be reported to, just to avoid any sort of situation where, you know, you have individuals who's reporting harassment to the harasser, right? You want to make sure that you prevent those sort of circumstances from happening. You want to make sure that your policy has some sort of statement that the employer will take any claim seriously and investigate promptly. You want to make sure that that policy has a statement that the employer will take any necessary corrective action to end the harassment, and that retaliation for reporting such claims will not be allowed. And you know, that's just one form, right, of having a policy. But once you have the policy, it does no good to have a policy if your employees are not informed of a policy and trained as to the policy and the procedures. So, you know, you want to make sure your employees are aware of any applicable and required state harassment training, and make sure that you regularly ensure that new employees receive the training, and certainly want to make sure that it is fresh on your employees' minds. If it is, you know, if there are requirements where there needs to be some sort of annual training. Also, you know, from an employer standpoint, if you receive a claim for unlawful harassment by an employee, then you need to respond to all harassment claims promptly and in a manner that is designed to and intended to end the harassment. That means investigate the claim promptly, gather and review any and all relevant evidence needed to make conclusions and determinations in that investigation, interviewing the complainant, the alleged harasser, any other witnesses who may be involved, making sure that you're documenting all the information that's received, and then being able to make your findings on whether and to what extent the harassment occurred. And then from the employer standpoint, you've got to take prompt corrective action like I mentioned, designed and intended to end the harassment. That may be, you know, considering certain actions that you may need to take to end the harassment. It may be terminating the harasser. It may be some sort of corrective action that you can provide to the harasser, informing all individuals who have knowledge of the complaint that retaliation is not going to be tolerated, following up to make sure that the corrective action ended the harassment. These are the things that employers will need to do to take that prompt action. It's all about documenting the complaint, the investigation, the findings, taking the corrective action, and then following up on those results. When employers have done those things, and really taking it seriously, what we've seen is that the individual who has brought the claim, who has been the victim of the harassment, they tend to be more inclined to engage with the employer throughout that process, and there's a morale booster to that, because your employees know that when things occur that should not occur in the workplace, that are wrong and unlawful, that employer, you as the employer, you're going to take, as a business, the company, you're going to take the right steps to correct that problem. And that can be a huge morale booster for a company. If you get it wrong, though, it can also be a public relations nightmare. And not only can it be a public relations nightmare, but you can find yourself incurring significant costs from a legal standpoint just to defend that unlawful action taken by one supervisor or one employee, and you know, those costs can they get driven up pretty quickly anytime a complaint is filed with the EEOC. So you want to make sure that you certainly treat it very seriously, and you take prompt actions to address the concern, the claim, because it can not only hurt you from a market standpoint, but it can hurt you from a bottom line standpoint as well.
Yeah, I tell my business clients is the last thing you want to be is newsworthy for issues like this. You don't want to be front page news and the News and Observer over harassment.
That's right.
Issue.
And no one wants to be a test case.
That's right. And one thing I remind our listeners, probably ad nauseum, but I've got a favorite Latin maximus, lex non favet delicatorum votis, and that translates to the law does not favor the wishes of the dainty. So would you say to the individuals who would be the offended parties in these cases that don't suffer in silence?
That is correct. You know, if you are a victim of some sort of harassment, unlawful harassment, then you need to speak up. More often than not, your employer, your company, they have a policy which prohibits and prevents harassment. And in order to be able to benefit from that policy, then you have certainly got to speak up and inform your employer of the conduct, the unwelcome and unwanted conduct that is occurring. Now, in doing that, the employer is going to, they are going to undergo some sort of investigation to determine, you know, whether or not the conduct is violating the policy, is it unlawful, or is it just some sort of conduct that, you know, may not necessarily violate a work policy, but it's just not the best conduct that should occur in the workplace. And, you know, if you, when you speak up, you give the employer the opportunity to be able to correct the wrong. If you never speak up and never say anything, then you can also harm your claim, in that you did not make your employer aware of it, such that they never knew or should have known that any unlawful conduct was occurring, and then they will not be liable to you for that harassment. Even if it is unlawful harassment, I mean, you've certainly got to make sure that you inform the employer of the conduct that is occurring and allow them to go forward with their investigation. And make a determination as to whether or not the conduct is violating the workplace policy or is unlawful. But you do yourself no good as an individual, as an employee, if you allow the conduct to occur and you know, in never saying anything or speaking up, raising the issue to your supervisor, or if your supervisor is the one who is the perpetrator of such conduct, then raising the issue with someone higher up within human resources. That is imperative to do if you are the victim of harassment.
So when we've made our complaint, it's been investigated, the employer and the employee reach an impasse over what to do about it, where does it go from there?
It's a great question, Joe. Oftentimes, you know, the employer and employee who has made a claim for unlawful harassment, they may disagree as to, you know, what took place and what the corrective action should be. And so if you're in the situation where you are the victim of harassment and you are not satisfied with your employer's conclusion, then you can file what is called a charge of discrimination with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, who will, as an independent third party, investigate your claim. And the EEOC, I mean, they have divisions who are designed to do just that, to investigate charges of unlawful harassment and various forms of unlawful discrimination, and they will look at what you've alleged as far as the facts that make up your harassment or your discrimination claim, and they will reach out to your employer, give them an opportunity to provide some sort of position statement as to, you know, what took place, what actions they took in response, and then the EEOC investigator may also interview the alleged harasser, the victim or the complainant, and other witnesses, and the EEOC will make a determination. The EEOC will either determine that there is cause or there is not cause as it relates to your complaint or your charge. And if the EEOC determines that there is cause, well, then 9 times out of 10, you can certainly go and find any plaintiff's employment lawyer who would be willing to litigate that case for you within the federal courts. Sometimes the EEOC, depending on how pervasive the behavior, or depending on if there are if it's of a nature where there are multiple individuals involved as far as being victims who have been harassed, the EEOC may litigate the action on their own on behalf of those that complainant or that group of complainants. And so the EEOC would be the legal advocate for those individuals and would basically sue your employer in federal court. There are also situations where the employer and the complainant may agree to mediate the issues involved in the charge. And all that means is the employer and the complaining victim have agreed that they would like to sit down in front of a independent third party, someone assigned by the EEOC, other than the investigator. And that individual will basically listen to the parties, listen to both sides of the positions, and try to help both the complaining victim employee and the employer come to some sort of resolution. I've participated and represented folks in those arenas as well during mediation. And that's usually a great opportunity to resolve whatever the alleged harassment or discrimination is. And oftentimes when employers choose to engage with me to represent them in EEOC matters or investigations, I will often encourage the employers to mediate, because it's a good opportunity to sit down, hear the side of the complaining victim, how they see it from their lens, and see if we can't work towards some sort of resolution.
That's good advice. We're going to have to wrap up, Xavier. We could have probably done three segments, but Xavier and I think are in agreement on many things. One of which is, if you've got a problem, we're prejudiced in favor of having a lawyer at a very early stage. And I can say with confidence, don't call Saul, call Xavier Lightfoot, just an outstanding young lawyer.
Well, you're
welcome. We're glad to have you, Xavier, that we've run out of time for today's episode of Legal Matters. Please be sure to tune in next time, fourth Tuesday of every month at 2 p.m., we rebroadcast Wednesdays at 7 a.m., and we hope you enjoyed the show and discovered information that will be helpful to you. Again, our guest was Xavier Lightfoot of Warden Smith here in Raleigh. Thank you so much for joining us, Xavier.
Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate it.
And the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. After it's broadcast, you can readily find it as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions from today's episode or wish to share a topic that you want us to explore, please call us at 919-832-5138, and you can reach us via email also at info@ncreading.org. Thank you so much for joining us.